Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast for Connecting Faith. You can hear the show each Monday through Thursday at noon Central. And remember, there are even more shows available on our website, myfaithradio.com.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. It's always nice to have you along. Glad that you can carve out a little time for the broadcast today. Especially helpful, I think. Brian sitting there across the control room there running things. Grace at the phones and looking forward to getting in today's guest. Ryan, is our topic today talks about the reality that maybe as many as one in four have some sort of mental illness. And you want to sort of lead. I was in a meeting this morning with four people, and so you just kind of look around and say, well, you know, is it I, Lord, that kind of thing. But anyway, so, and in my case, it may be. But, I mean, it's really not a laughing matter. We are kind of uncomfortable. We don't know how to deal with it, right?
That's societal, right?
Yeah.
So few of us actually know how to even begin a conversation. Yeah. About mental illness.
Yeah, and so we're going to dive in today because there's a wonderful resource that's out, and it's good reading, but it's I was telling Ryan before the show that, you know, every page I turn is kind of like, oh no. Let me introduce my guest today, and we'll talk about it. The book is called Troubled Minds, Mental Illness, and the Church's Mission, and it's written by Amy Simpson. Amy is currently editor of giftedforleadership.com, and she's managing editor of Marriage and Parenting Resources for Today's Christian Woman, and she's served on the team at Christianity Today for a while, and has authored another book called Into the Word: How to Get the Most Out of Your Bible. And this was a story that Amy wasn't interested in writing because a lot of it has her story written all over it, at least her family. Amy, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks. It's great to be here with you.
We don't know how to, to respond. And as I was saying, that as I read your stories, you kind of told it a bit. It's like every page you turn and go, oh, that's difficult. And it just sort of got more difficult. And that almost seems like maybe the sum of life with those that have mental illness, that it sort of gets more difficult, doesn't it?
That's certainly true for some people. In fact, people who have a more chronic and serious form of mental illness, like my mother does, with an illness like schizophrenia, you are in for usually a long haul with an illness like that. But I should say, for all of the trouble that my family has been through and all the difficulty that we've faced, we've also seen God's grace in tremendous ways throughout that time as well. So.
And that comes through in the book too. We'll talk about that. In fact, that's one of the kind of the reasons you wrote the book, is to talk about, you know, how can we as the body of Christ relate, support, and encourage those that are struggling with troubled minds and the families that love and care for them as well. But let's talk maybe just definitions a bit. Who decides what the mental illness is, and talk about some statistics.
Yeah, that's a good question. The definition of mental illness, and this is fairly, it would be a widely accepted definition. The National Alliance on Mental Illness defines it as medical conditions that disrupt a person's thinking, feeling, mood, ability to relate to others, and daily functioning. And this is key. They often result in a diminished capacity for coping with the ordinary demands of life. So by definition, for something to be considered a mental illness, it needs to cause impairment to the level that someone's ability to handle daily life is not what it should be. So it's not a matter of just feeling down one day or feeling kind of worried or, you know, you're not quite yourself that day. It's something more serious and disruptive than that. There are different agencies who kind of have their own ways of defining mental illness, but they would pretty much all have these elements in common.
There is the big psychiatric book that's sort of the Bible of illnesses, and it seems like there's always some debate every year when they update or wherever, and there's always something more added.
Yeah, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM, they just recently came out with the DSM-5, and this is actually a resource that they update every 10 to 15 years. So it's been a while since the last update, and there are some significant changes to the manual this time around. There's some controversy around that because mental illness, psychiatry, psychology, brain science, these are not necessarily exact sciences. Their brain science itself is really a frontier in the world of science, and there's a lot of subjectivity to psychology and psychiatry. So yes, there's some controversy around that. And the National Institutes of Mental Health, which is a government agency, has been part of that controversy, criticizing the DSM-5 for some of the categories that they've put in the manual and some of the ways that they've defined mental illness. The National Institutes of Mental Health is where I've gotten my definitions and my categories of mental illness that I use in Troubled Minds. The DSM-5 is a little bit more, goes into much greater detail than your average layperson would want to go. But yeah, there is some controversy there, although these big general categories of mental illness are not really controversial. It's more some of the details and some of what is now being classified as mental illness that hasn't been in the past.
But those in the big categories, though, it is pretty pervasive, isn't it? I mean, in terms of surprising number of people that are afflicted or affected in some way.
Yeah. Studies show that somewhere around 25%, most sources will say around more like 26% of adults in the United States suffer from a diagnosable mental illness each year, and that doesn't include children and adolescents. Now, that number, that percentage does sound surprising to most people. I think most people have no idea just how common it is to suffer from a mental illness. I think largely that's because, as you were talking about at the beginning of the program, we don't talk about this very often. We don't really know how to talk about it, and there's a level of discomfort that keeps us from sharing our own stories. So we don't often hear other people saying they've experienced this, so we tend to think it's happening more on the margins of our society, or there are fewer people who are going through it than actually are.
And we'll have you share a bit about your story in a moment, too. But I was interested, you were talking about, you know, this is not exact science, certainly in the Christian community, maybe in general, but there's a sort of a mistrust of psychology and psychiatry anyway, isn't it? So does that sort of add to some of the challenges when we as believers, or at least the church, looks at this issue?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a big issue in the church. We have this, in many churches, this sense of mistrust. It's kind of a suspicion of psychology. And I think that's partly related to history when psychology was in its infancy, and Freud especially was very influential in the formation of the science, and some other leading thinkers at that time who were really actually anti-religion and developed theories and therapeutic practices that treated religion with suspicion. So then religious people, people of faith, sort of looked back at them with suspicion as well. But a lot of church leaders and a lot of Christians don't really realize that kind of psychology is very much passé these days. What most psychology professionals are practicing is not Freudian psychology. It's completely different, and it's generally got a level of respect or even totally embracing the importance of faith and spirituality in people's lives.
You talk about several other books that are kind of sort of landmark books in terms of how Christians tend to respond to illness, and talk about how, you know, if we broke our leg, we'd go get it mended. But somehow, when it's issues of the mind, we think we should be treated differently.
Yeah, we tend to forget, I think, or maybe not realize. And I think, again, this is largely based in history when we've had some other understandings of what's happening with mental illness. But we tend to forget that our brain is an organ, and therefore, it's subject to the same forces of decay and sickness and disease that the rest of our bodies are. What we tend to think of, oh, if it's a mental illness, it must be, you know, must be something different. It must be spiritual in nature, or it must be something that I can control, versus a broken leg or a case of cancer. Well, we know what that is because we've seen the ultrasound, we've seen the biopsy results, we can see the person wearing a cast. You know, with the brain, we don't really typically see what's going on with a person, but that doesn't make it any less real in the physical realm. And I think we need to grow in our understanding of the vulnerability of the brain to all kinds of disruptions, whether it's a disease or an injury or just a disruption in our thinking that causes us to go down the wrong path and get stuck for a while.
I'm guessing that this is probably a topic that you really didn't have a lot of interest in pursuing. I mean, even though we'll have you share a bit about your story in a moment, but it kind of started right through work where you end up doing a survey of churches, right?
Yeah, I actually, this is a topic that I never thought I would write about until recently, because this is something that had such a profound impact on my life in a painful way and caused a lot of confusion and heartache for me and my family, and something that I tried to hide for a long time. I didn't talk about my family's experience with mental illness. So God really brought me on a journey to a point where he really actually started to whisper, I think, to me that this maybe it's time for me to begin sharing or doing something with the experience of I've had in order to minister to other people. So I had a conversation with another editor here, Marshall Shelley, who's the editor of Leadership Journal. And we talked about, I told him I'd be available or interested if he ever wanted someone to do some writing on this topic. And so we talked about that, and I ended up sharing my story with him. And we talked about doing a survey, and it all kind of went from there. So, yeah, once I started doing that survey and understanding more about how churches are currently responding to mental illness and began to understand just how common it is, I realized there may be a way that my story actually could be a ministry to other people, and doing some work on my end in terms of research and interviewing others could make a difference in the church.
We'll hear Amy Simpson's story in just a moment, and we're going to talk about the book that she's written, Troubled Minds, Mental Illness and the Church's Mission. And our focus is to get to ways that we as God's people can be more supportive, caring, and just how understanding how families in our churches, our neighborhoods, maybe just right in our own family are affected by this, and get some good practical insight and advice. And hear Amy's story. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we do have, I think, about five or six copies, actually, of Amy's book that we'd be happy to put in your hands. You want to join the broadcast at 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. If you've got a story to share or just some encouragement that you've found, I mean, what has made a difference for you, how your faith has played a part in this, you're welcome to join the conversation, 877-93-FAITH, or online, myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page. We'll continue with Amy Simpson in just a moment.
Psalm 145:8 encourages me when I think of my family members who have not received Jesus. The Lord is kind and merciful, slow to get angry, full of unfailing love. None of us deserve even one day of heaven because of our ugly sin. We can be so thankful for a patient God who delays His justice. Dr. Jode was the head of the philosophy department at the University of London. He was known for undermining Christianity in the college world. He believed that God was an impersonal part of the cosmos, that there was no such thing as sin. But before he died, Dr. Jode came to the understanding that there was sin as the Bible ascribes, and the only solution for sin was the cross of Jesus Christ. Like the Apostle Paul, he became passionate about following Jesus. God's love delayed justice and gave this man time to recognize his sin and receive life in Christ. In this instance, justice delayed is condemnation denied. God's patience works to our advantage every day. For more encouragement, visit DebbieGriffith.com.
18 past the hour. Happy to have with us today Amy Simpson. Amy is part of the leadership team at Christianity Today. In fact, serves as managing editor of Marriage and Parenting Resources for Today's Christian Woman, one of the resources available at CT. And she's written a new book called Troubled Minds, Mental Illness and the Church's Mission, published by University Press, and it's recommended reading. Amy, I want to just invite you to share a little about your story and just maybe out of that, talk about, as you describe in the book, there are a number of ways that families are affected, families suffer, and maybe just sort of talk about and kind of work through the progression a bit as we go along.
Yeah, when I was a child, my dad was a pastor in small rural congregations. My mom was obviously the pastor's wife, and she played a role in church leadership, church ministry as well. We didn't know that there was anything wrong in our family, that there was mental illness present. My mom showed some symptoms of illness, but we didn't recognize them for what they were. She was basically what I would call a quirky person, and probably struck people as maybe fragile or having some weaknesses that made her have a hard time handling some of what life throws people's way. So when I was a child, I just kind of saw her that way. I thought she was normal, of course, because she was my mom and that was what I was used to. But I knew that she wasn't a strong person who could really handle a lot of anxiety or stress. And so my family was sort of careful to protect mom and help her kind of avoid stress and that kind of thing. But again, that was all normal for us. So we didn't know that there was anything wrong beyond that. But when I got a little older, when I was 13, my family moved from the rural area where we lived. My dad left his position at the church, and we resettled in the city, right in an urban area. And that was a big change for our family. There was some culture shock there and some major adjustment to a kind of a different way of life and a different environment. My dad was out of work for a long time. He was looking for work, and when he did find work, he was underemployed. He was employed in temp jobs and positions like that that didn't pay much at all. So my family really, we had never had much working at these small rural churches as a pastor, and we really actually sank into poverty at that point. So there was a lot of financial stress. My mom was very, very stressed by things like driving in city traffic. Obviously, my dad's unemployment. There was a strain in their marriage. My oldest sibling, my brother, graduated from high school that year and left home. So that was a big change for the family as well. So we had a lot of stress on our family, and a lot of this fell on my mom, and she just wasn't able to handle it. Because she had this mental illness that had not fully shown itself yet, it was too much for her. So this stress did cause her mental illness to become more apparent and to really fully blossom in her. When I was 14, I was at school and I had track practice. I was on the track team. So after school, I stayed there. And my dad would usually pick me up on his way home from work, and he didn't show up that day. So I called home, and a neighbor answered the phone, told me that my mom had been taken to the hospital, and she thought she had a stroke or something. So I walked home, and while I was walking home, I was wondering what had happened to mom, and, you know, was she even alive? You know, had she died, or, you know, what did that – I didn't really even know what a stroke was at that point. And, you know, those were just the casual words that my neighbor had used. But I wondered if I had lost my mom at that point. When I got home, I understood more about what had happened. And it turned out my mom hadn't died. She hadn't had a stroke. She'd been taken to a psychiatric hospital because she'd had a full psychotic break and completely lost touch with reality. I didn't really understand what that meant either at that time, and nobody in my family really understood the full implications of that. But it turned out that the way I understand it now, and I didn't really understand at the time, that I really did lose my mom in a way that day. And that would happen over and over again then throughout my life from that point on. My mom has been diagnosed with schizophrenia, and she has been through 20-plus years since then of hospitalizations, medication, times where she was stable and functioning fairly well, although still impaired, and then times when she would decline again and go back to the hospital and need to have her medications adjusted, or times when she wasn't taking the medications properly or they didn't work as they had before. So we've really been through, you know, a long period of kind of a roller coaster ride with that illness, and it's affected all of us tremendously. I am happy to say that my mom is doing very well right now. So just to kind of put that out there and offer a little bit of hope to other people who may be going through the same thing. She is doing really well right now. But yeah, we've been through some hard times there.
Encourage you read the book. You can read more about the story in a bit more detail and about the encouragement and the help as well. Troubled Minds is the name of the book, Mental Illness and the Church's Mission. Amy Simpson's my guest. And we may have, you know, some challenges with our phones at the moment. So in case you're trying to get through, it might work better to do email or even Facebook, Connecting Faith and Neil Stavem. And you can send us a note that way, or myfaithradio.com, and then click on the Connecting Faith show page. There's an email link there. Amy, just a couple of things sparked my thought. Is it progressive usually? So if untreated, it is going to get progressively worse. Is that right or not?
Yes, for schizophrenia at least, yes, that's usually the case. If someone is untreated, their illness will probably get worse and become a more profoundly disabling illness. Although the illness itself is somewhat unpredictable too, you don't always know how it's going to progress for a person. And in some people, they actually reach a certain age where it may start to improve. So, for example, in like their 60s and 70s, a lot of patients show some improvement and some stabilization. But again, it's somewhat unpredictable. My mom has been through a lot of what I would call different phases of her illness when it has manifested itself in different ways, and she's shown different types of symptoms. I think that's fairly typical for people. They kind of go through phases. And then for other types of mental illness, you know, it's completely different. Schizophrenia is kind of its own thing in terms of the type of illness and the effect it has on people and the way it's treated. But other illnesses may be different. But many have that sort of cyclical nature where even something like depression, which many people suffer from, may come and go and have that sort of cyclical pattern to it.
I was also wondering, too, are there triggers? Is it usually something, a trigger, sets something off, or does it just sort of develop sort of unfold?
Yeah, again, I would say that depends largely on the type of mental illness and certainly on the specific person. With something like schizophrenia, schizophrenia is so biologically based. It's very much about brain chemistry. So there's usually a point in a person's life, often when they're in young adulthood, where something biological, whether it's a genetic trigger or an environmental trigger, that sort of turns on that switch, happens, and that illness begins to become apparent. But with other illnesses, it may be the trigger point may be a time of grief and loss. It may be, again, a time of great stress, or it may be really sort of random. You know, you wake up one morning and you can't get out of bed and you don't care about life the way you used to care about life. And you're in a depressive episode and you're not sure what brought that on. But there's probably multiple factors at work. For most mental illness, again, I mentioned brain science is sort of a frontier science right now. For most mental illness, there's not complete confidence on what causes that illness. Although for most people are fairly certain they know that there's whether there's a genetic link present, a genetic factor present, there's usually an environmental factor. There can be lifestyle issues as well, or spiritual issues, relational issues that all sort of work together to cause someone to suffer from a mental illness. So they're not simple. You know, none of them are really simple in terms of what causes them and what helps people get better.
which is probably one of the challenges for us, too, is because we prefer simple and we like people to get better. And this is one of those things where it takes quite a while to kind of diagnose and get right. In fact, we're in a moment or so, we're going to come back and we're going to talk more about medications and just sort of trying to balance that out, talk more about, privacy laws. That was something that sort of surprised me, and how that kind of inhibits some of what happens. It was a few decades ago where we deinstitutionalized a number of people, and that had some consequences. We'll talk a little about that. And then we'll talk about, pastors and churches and the God's people that just want to make a difference, do the right thing, but don't necessarily know what to do. We'll get some good advice from Amy Simpson on that, and encourage you to join with us, and apologize for some of our phone issues today, but you can certainly drop us a note online, myfaithradio.com, and then go to the Connecting Faith show page and send us an email there, or Facebook, it's Connecting Faith and Neil Stavem, and you can send us a note that way. Amy Simpson is currently editor of giftedforleadership.com, and she's part of the writing team at Christianity Today, serving as managing editor of Marriage and Parenting Resources for Today's Christian Woman. And has written the book Troubled Minds, Mental Illness, and the Church's Missions from University Press. And more with Amy in just a moment.
'Cause I'll be by your side wherever you fall. Dead of night, whenever you call. And please don't fight these hands that are holding you. And my hands are holding you.
32 past the hour. And we're talking today about mental illness and the church's mission. That's the subtitle for the new book, Troubled Minds, written by Amy Simpson. Amy's part of the executive team at Christianity Today, the groups there, which include Today's Christian Woman, which she manages the editing for the Marriage and Parenting Resources there. Also is currently editor for giftedforleadership.com, and has told a bit about her story in the book Troubled Minds. We're talking about mental illness, not the sort of thing that the people like to talk about often. And we want to care. We don't know necessarily what to do. And Amy, we're going to get to that in a moment. Talk a bit about the medications. It was interesting to me as I was reading the book that, the medications are, because this isn't an exact science, that there's a lot of sort of trial and error, and that oftentimes hospitals don't really help because they sort of push us out before we get an idea to see how things are really working.
Yeah, the average hospital, psychiatric hospital stay has gone down over the last several decades, and it's now about 4 days. For the average time for a medication to begin to work is at minimum 2 weeks, a psychiatric medication. So usually people are in and out of the hospital before the doctors even have a sense for whether their medication is going to help them at all. So there's a lot of, like you said, a lot of trial and error involved for one person's mental health issue may require one type of medication. Someone else who comes in with the exact same symptoms may need an entirely different medication. Sometimes people need more than one medication to help sort of balance their brain chemistry and help them manage the symptoms so that they can, for example, go through therapy and be productive with therapy and start working toward health. So medications are critically important for many people with mental illness, but sometimes the process of finding the right medication may take it's not uncommon at all for that to take a year for someone to really find the right drug or mix of drugs. It can be a very frustrating experience for the person with the illness, very frustrating for someone who's trying to care for them, frustrating for doctors as well, who are sort of have their hands tied often by the insurance companies who, like you said, kind of push people out of hospital stays and try to keep expenses low, but people may need to actually end up going back to the hospital a lot more because they're experiencing symptoms, they're experiencing new side effects, the medication's not working, where if they had a longer hospital stay at the beginning, they may have avoided some of those repeat visits. So, yeah, that can be a frustrating and difficult process for people, but I will say the medications themselves can also literally save people's lives, and I get really frustrated when I hear people discourage others from taking medication, psychiatric medication. We don't discourage other people from taking, for example, pain medications after they have surgery, or even when they have a terrible headache, or some kind of medication, insulin if they have diabetes, you know, that helps people function better with the conditions they have or maybe even helps them heal. But we, for some reason, we do often discourage people from taking psychiatric medications, or we feel uncomfortable with that ourselves because of that sense of stigma, when really we need to often encourage people that it's okay to take that medication. It doesn't mean that you're giving up. It doesn't mean that you're going to become a different person. Often it means that you're going to be able to function at a level that you need to in order to get better, you know, to work toward health. And for some people, it means taking medication for the rest of their lives, like someone like my mom, who has schizophrenia. It's a disease that has that biological component that does mean she'll be on medication for the rest of her life, and that's okay. People with diabetes will be on medication for the rest of their lives, too, and that's okay. It's a supplemental resource that she needs to function at a healthy level and to be the productive person God made her to be.
And we won't probably take time to get into issues about, you know, so getting off the meds, but that's a whole other issue. There's another area that I want to talk about. You sort of mentioned about, you know, insurance companies kind of pushing people out. There's also the challenge of the privacy laws. So talk about how that really kind of hamstrings people that maybe want to help.
Yeah, and there's actually even a broader issue than that in terms of the mental health care system. It is a very difficult system to navigate, and in many ways it's badly broken. It's a fractured system. So the people who find themselves, say, in a psychiatric hospital because they've had an incident that has brought them there may find themselves then with, over the next 10 years, seeing a new doctor every 6 months, going in and out of hospitals, maybe never the same hospital. Their medical records are not following them around, so they're sort of starting from scratch each time. The insurance companies don't necessarily cover mental health care at the same level that they cover other types of health care, so it can be tremendously expensive. And then there's the issue of those privacy laws that you mentioned. Because the privacy laws are in place, and they are in place for a good reason, so I don't want to discount the importance of respecting people's privacy. However, they really do create a serious problem for, especially for families of people who are caring for those with mental illness, because they assume that the person who's got the illness is in a position to manage their own health care. And sometimes that's just not the case. So, for example, someone like my mom, who may have to go to a psychiatric hospital because she's in the middle of a psychotic episode, is not in a position to sign a consent form granting consent for doctors to talk with her husband, my dad. But unfortunately, that's what's required in order for them to talk to him. So if she won't sign that consent form, or if she doesn't understand what it is, the doctors can't discuss her condition with her husband, and they'll send her home from the hospital without him knowing what medication she's on, how often she needs to take them, whether she needs follow-up care with a therapist somewhere or with a day program somewhere, how best to help her at home. There's very little interaction with family members, very little support of family to enable them to provide the best care they can, let alone to help them understand exactly what they're dealing with. So it's sort of like someone has a heart attack and they go to the hospital, they're treated there, and then they're sent home without anybody ever actually telling the family members, this person had a heart attack. They need to eat differently. They need to exercise differently. You know, their lifestyle needs to change so that they can manage their heart health from this point forward. Well, if families don't know that, they may assume that this person just had a little glitch or an incident, a one-time incident that's now taken care of, and now we can go back to life as it was before. We don't expect people to do that, but we do expect people to do that in managing mental health diagnoses, because that information sharing just isn't there. So, yeah, there's a serious problem with privacy laws and the difficulty in getting information to families and other people who are trying to care for those with mental illness.
Yeah, the words that come to mind are probably not appropriate for the discussion, but that's just crazy. I mean, that is just that doesn't make any sense at all. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
One of the people I interviewed for the book Troubled Minds said, you know, I hear people say this person's crazy or that person's crazy, or in this case, this was another person who had a mother with mental illness. She said, people say my mom is crazy, but you know what's crazy is that system, that system that doesn't think that family members need to be equipped to care for people who are suffering.
Amy, let's talk about some of the pastors and church leaders you've talked to who want to do the right thing but just don't know what to do. I mean, what's your assessment, I guess, of how we're doing now? I mean, is it the case that we shy away from talking about it? We don't recognize it in our churches. I mean, I think we all know that there's probably people in our congregations that experience some sort of difficulties, but we don't want the disruption, or it's not. I don't know what it is. It doesn't look good or feel good, whatever it might be.
Yeah, the survey that I conducted among church leaders, I got 500 responses to the survey. 98% of them said they had seen some type of mental illness in their congregation. And I was surprised by that response because I didn't necessarily think church leaders would be quite that aware of mental illness within their own communities. But 98% said, yes, we've seen some type of mental illness right in my congregation. But only 12.5% of them said that mental illness is discussed in an open and healthy way in their church. So there's a huge gap between awareness of mental illness, not just in general, but within their own churches, and then the way they feel they're dealing with it in their churches. 16% of church leaders said they don't feel equipped at all to minister to people with mental illness. And only 3% of church leaders said they would consider themselves an expert in that area. So there's some lack of confidence in dealing with mental illness, which is understandable because most of us feel that way when it comes to mental illness. And I don't want to come down too hard on church leaders because, like you said, these are people who want to do the right thing. They're doing ministry in Jesus' name, and they want to do the best they can for the people who are in their congregations. But there is that sense of, I don't know what to do in a situation like this. I don't know how to help someone who has this kind of illness. And like I said, we all feel that. So I think we need to have some greater awareness of exactly what is helpful in these situations, the role that church leaders and church members can play, and just exactly how we can help, because we tend to apparently lay this expectation on ourselves that we need to somehow heal them or we need to help them make progress in managing their illness. Well, that's not really a job for most of us. Most of us are not qualified to do that. And we don't feel that same burden when it comes to things like, I gave the example earlier, a heart attack. When someone in the church has a heart attack, the rest of us don't typically feel like, I don't know what to do in this situation because somehow I need to help this person's heart become healthier. We don't focus on that. We focus on, okay, this person has a health issue. I'm not qualified to help with the health issue, but I know that they're getting treatment and I know that their family's probably going to need support. And so I'm going to come around them and help them give that kind of support to them. Well, that's really the same kind of approach we can use with mental illness, but it's not usually the first thing we think of because there's so much fear and stigma and the sense of mystery and, intimidation around the topic of mental illness, we tend to sort of freeze up in the face of it. And that's certainly reflected in the results of the survey I did with church leaders.
Well, you're talking about a heart attack example. I mean, this is not, mental illness isn't the sort of thing where we're bringing lunches and casseroles by the house, is it?
That's right. In fact, a lot of people call mental illness the no casserole illness because typically you won't have people come bring meals after a psychiatric hospitalization or an episode of depression where, say, a parent in the family literally can't get out of bed for a week. People tend to keep their distance. They stay away rather than coming around and offering that kind of practical support.
So that's what we do, whether we mean to or not. So we'd like to change that. And in a moment, we'll give Amy an opportunity to talk about maybe what she'd like to see churches or God's people do and how they can respond, how we can respond in a more Christ-like way. We'll hear more from Amy Simpson in just a moment. She's written a new book called Troubled Minds. Subtitle is Mental Illness and the Church's Mission. And it is published by University Press. Amy is currently editor for giftedforleadership.com. and managing editor of Marriage and Parenting Resources for Today's Christian Woman, formerly vice president, publisher, editor, and director of the Church Ministry Media Group at Christianity Today. And she's also authored the book Into the Word, How to Get the Most from Your Bible. We'll talk about how we can be better equipped and to be more encouraging and loving and accepting and supporting. All that and more with Amy Simpson in just a moment.
This is Wayne Peterson, president of HCJB Global, with Beyond the Call. Dr. Joe just knew something was wrong. Maria was due any day now, but something just wasn't right. When Dr. Joe checked extensively for a heartbeat, he couldn't find one. The baby had passed away, and Maria would need to have C-section right away. As Dr. Joe prepared for surgery, a chaplain began to pray for Maria and her baby. He prayed that the child would live. As Dr. Joe heard him pray, he thought, that's not going to happen. But when Dr. Joe passed the child to a midwife to work on Maria, he suddenly heard a loud baby's cry. It was Maria's child, alive and well. God had heard the prayers of the chaplain because he had faith. Have a need today? Give it to God and see what happens. This is Wayne Peterson. What is God asking you to do today? Make it a day that you go beyond the call. And then visit us online at hcjb.org.
Past the hour, Amy Simpson is my guest. She's authored a great resource called Troubled Minds, Mental Illness and the Church's Mission. And we're talking about some of her experience and the system and the church. And Amy, I think as you've talked about, when you've encountered pastors that, you know, and many of us feel that we're not equipped at all to handle this. And, you know, these can be disruptive situations in our churches and schools or whatever it might be. So how can, what would you say is maybe the first thing or ways that we can be more Christ-like in caring for those around us in our midst that suffer from mental illness?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons we tend to be so uncomfortable around mental illness and people with mental illness is because we tend to have, you know, we have certain expectations for what our church community should look like. And we have this emphasis on, you know, how Jesus changed my life. Jesus gives me victory over sin. My relationship with Christ makes me happy. And we sort of subtly believe and send the message to others that that's what the Christian life is about. It's about being happy. It's about being attractive. It's about having a good life as we would define it here on earth. It's not really a biblical concept to believe that that's what the Christian life is all about. In fact, Jesus told us very clearly, you will have trouble in this life. You will suffer. The New Testament says that over and over again. Peter and Paul and these great apostles of the faith tell us, you will suffer. And God can do great things with your suffering, but you will suffer. So we need to change, first of all, change our expectations for what the Christian life is about, not only for ourselves, but for others. Because when we believe that the Christian life is about being happy and attractive and healthy all the time, then when someone doesn't fit that model, we tend to condemn them. So there's a lot of condemnation that falls on people who are affected by mental illness, as well as their family members, because when we have that sort of attitude, we assume that they must be doing something wrong. Or that they have some kind of spiritual problem or a sin in their life that is at the root of their mental illness. So we need to revisit, I think the really, truly the most basic thing we need to do is revisit our theology of suffering and sin and come to grips with the fact that mental illness really does fit perfectly with a Christian view of what this life is like and what we should expect in a world where our planet is polluted by sin and where all of us are subject to the forces of decay and disease. Even if we're in relationship with Jesus, that doesn't mean that we've been taken out of this world where the consequences of sin have their way with people in many ways. So when we start changing that theology and start wrestling and acknowledging our own brokenness, I think we'll see a new humility in each of us that will give us a different attitude toward people affected by mental illness and We can create a more healthy and loving environment that accepts people with mental illness as people who have problems that come as a result of the sin in this world, just like the rest of us do. And we're all brothers and sisters in Christ who are working toward toward God's kingdom and toward that ultimate redemption someday, and we all have great hope in that, and we're in this together.
But
so in the meantime, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, is it reasonable, though, to expect that or hope that someone gets better? I mean, we have, you know, churches have recovery programs, recovery groups. I mean, are we giving the wrong message here?
Yeah, it really depends on the person. There are some types of mental illness where people are more likely to have a true and lasting recovery. There are other types of illness like schizophrenia, like my mom has, where it's not reasonable to expect something that's a true recovery. It's more reasonable to expect the person to manage that illness over time. And that's the case with many. So when we have this this language of recovery, which is very appropriate to many problems in people's lives, but when we apply that same idea to people with mental illness, we're really placing kind of a false, heavy expectation on them that sends the message, you know, you can join with us in our community as a full part of this community once you've gotten over that. We don't really want you here until then. And that's the message that a lot of people with mental illness and their families have received from the church. We see your mess. We assume there's probably something wrong with you, something that you've done wrong to deserve that mess. Go get that fixed. Go recover from that. Maybe we'll help you get over it. And then once you're past that, then you can join us and be a member of Christ's body with the rest of us. Well, it's not reasonable for a lot of people, and it's not Christ-like. It's not a Christ-like attitude. Christ came to redeem all of us while we were still in our sin. He works with all of us. He loves all of us unconditionally, despite all of our messes that we have in all of our lives. And we need to do the same. We need to grant the same thing to each other. That doesn't mean that we don't have any expectations for people. I think it's very appropriate for us to set strong boundaries for people with mental illness, to set expectations for what is and is not acceptable within the community, and then to to enforce those boundaries so that we can actually help aid in their management of their illness. That can be an important part of helping someone get better. But we need to be reasonable in those expectations and recognize when the expectations we have for other people are really just about our own comfort rather than truly the health of the body of Christ.
Can you give maybe just our time is kind of getting short, and I sort of interrupted you as you're talking about, you know, Christ-like response, but can you maybe just give an example of where godly care is taking place, or, you know, a church or a pastor or somebody that you encountered said, this is a good model?
Yeah, in Troubled Minds, I actually spend a whole chapter on ideas that churches can use and profiled four different programs in different churches around the country who are doing a great job here. One example is, and I should say one thing that all of those churches have in common is that their ministries are led by people who themselves have experienced a mental illness or have a close family member who's experienced a mental illness. So people who've kind of gone through it are actually really well equipped to do ministry to others who are in that place. But one example I'll share, this man who had a struggle with serious depression, and when he came to his church for help, they basically, as he put it, they tried to pray it out of him. They chalked it up to a spiritual problem and blamed him for his illness, and then they were surprised and discouraged when he didn't get better as a result of their efforts to cure him with spiritual exercise. So he ended up leaving that church and going and getting medical intervention, getting medication, getting therapy, which his church had discouraged him from doing. When he made that choice, he felt like he was having to choose between the church and health, which we should never put anyone in that position. But he did get better. The medication helped him, the therapy helped him, and he eventually was able to find a new church community where they were loving and accepting toward him despite the depression that he still struggled with off and on. Eventually, when he was in a very healthy place. He talked with people in the church. One of the pastors asked him to start a ministry to other people affected by mental illness as an outreach program from their church. Well, when he started announcing this outreach program to people in the church, all these people in his church kept coming to him secretly, like he said, like Nicodemus in the night, coming to him saying, "Don't tell anybody, but I struggle with this too," or "Please don't tell anyone, but someone in my family is suffering from a mental illness." No one felt like they could publicly say what they were going through, but there were all these people within his own church who themselves needed this kind of ministry. So it turned out to be not only an outreach program, but an internal ministry as well, and grew into a thriving program that is reaching, not only changing the families in his church, but reaching families outside the church and doing really fantastic life-giving ministry to them. And he's found a whole new purpose for and calling for his life. He does this full-time on staff with his church and just has a fantastic model in providing support groups and just helping people in those practical ways and helping them get that spiritual shepherding as they're going through treatment. One thing that we sometimes do is give people referrals to outside care, thinking they're getting all their needs met there, and then we've kind of done our job. But it's important for the church to recognize that sending someone to a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a counselor does not mean they're getting everything they need. We still need to walk alongside them as spiritual friends and spiritual directors, as pastors, and just people who are going to be in their lives as friends, offering friendship, not walking away from them and abandoning them when they need the church most.
Hey, we just have about 30 seconds left. This is an issue that's not without hope, though, right?
Absolutely. There is great hope, not only in medically speaking, because this at this time there's never been more hope for treatment. Some of the treatments for mental illness are up to 90% effective. Now, only about half of people with mental illness actually are receiving treatment, but those who are treated can be very successful in managing their illnesses. But there's, aside from that hope, there is great hope in Christ, and the church has that hope we can offer to other people. In this life, Christ redeems our sufferings, and in the future, he will redeem us ultimately by recreating ourselves with new bodies and new brains, and we'll be able to enjoy him in a whole new way.
Amy Simpson has written a wonderful resource. It's published by University Press, called Troubled Minds, Mental Illness, and the Church's Mission. Amy is part of the leadership group at Christianity Today and serves as currently editor of giftedforleadership.com. Has joined us telling her story. Amy, thank you so much for sharing and for writing openly in the book and for sharing with us today.
Thank you.
Amy Simpson joining us here on Connecting Faith. We put the program up on the podcast, so you have an opportunity to hear it again, pass it on to a friend. I hope that you will. And to check out the book Troubled Minds from University Press. And join us again tomorrow for Connecting Faith as we talk creation and intelligent design.